Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. This is Lana. Joining me is Piero San Giorgio, a Swiss author and former businessman and software executive. For the past decade, he has studied the global economic system and its dependence on ever-expanding populations, debt, and resource exploitation. He's the author of several books, including Survive the Economic Collapse, and his latest, which we'll discuss, called Women on the Verge of Societal Breakdown. Piero will explain the fragility of our modern liberal world and how, as our contemporary society collapses, a woman will find herself in an extremely vulnerable position. Thinking in terms of no borders, liberal politics, and social upheaval, coupled with our dependence on the system for survival, we talk about how this is a ticking time bomb and how women will suffer if not prepared. Piero San Giorgio, up next. Welcome, Piero San Giorgio. How are you today?
Great. I'm very happy to be on your show.
Well, I hear you've been traveling Europe. You're working on a new book. Any spoilers you can give us?
Let's say that it will involve a lot of information about the invasion of Europe and who's behind it. But that's for some time in the future.
Well, I think that the research into the migrant invasion actually fits with your new book, Women on the Verge of Societal Breakdown, because feminists claim, you know, women fought so hard for their freedom, which we'll question in a bit. But it seems that if leftist trends continue and if feminists keep defending Islam, it might end with women being stoned to death in the streets, you know? I mean, what is it with feminists loving Islam? Some say they actually want to be dominated. Others say they just hate European men. But what do you think?
Well, you know, to tell you the story about this book, you know, when my first book came out, Survive the Economic Collapse, and surprisingly for me, as a, you know, I was not a writer at the time, a full-time writer, it had a huge success. And I noticed that most of the readers, actually 80%, 90%, were men. And I was wondering, interestingly, we are in a world where women, through feminism, have received all the rights, if and perhaps even more than men, and therefore they should be just like men, thinking about the future and thinking about protecting their society. And obviously, that was not the case. Not many women were interested about what I was explaining about why our world is collapsing, our global economy is going bad, and therefore the risks that are linked to that. And I was thinking, well, hold on a second, the woman have more to suffer, because when a society collapses, that means there is no law, there's no more protection, and women have always been the prize for razzia, for war, for conquest, and therefore it could be very dangerous for them. So I start to think about feminism, and I was thinking, after all, in the history of mankind, there's never been any time like the past hundred years where women have had these rights and this power that they have fought for and acquired over the time. And I must say, this is a European and to some extent American, but you understand it's a Western approach. And of course, I was thinking, how come in the West, after 100 years of gaining these rights and gaining these privileges, women have seemed to fail to understand that it's also their responsibility to protect their societies, to protect their civilization, and if only to protect themselves. And so, of course, I studied feminism. This is what I write in the first part of the book. Why and what were the mechanisms that brought, in a historical perspective, to bring women to the forefront of political and, you know, labor and working and at some point eventually it went too far, and today it seems that the feminism that is certainly vocal is one that is against women.
It is against
white men, and it's against Western civilization. So at some point there has been some hijacking by cultural Marxism and other forces to make sure that women basically have become free to be slaves. They have become free to be consumers. They have become freed to be prisoners of their own needs, or rather of their own wants. such as shopping, and you just have to see literature for women. It's extremely disappointing. It's not, I mean, freedom and elevation and rights for what?
Yeah.
For shopping, for having to work just as men, for having to not having children anymore because you don't have time. You need to have a career. And what career? To be a glorified secretary?
Yeah.
To be working as a saleswoman in consumer shops, and for this, women have sacrificed family, children, and that means people that will take care of them when they're old, and that means probably they have sacrificed husbands, caring men, because in a world where women are free, men feel that they don't need to protect them anymore, and therefore don't have also the moral imperative to stay with them and to stay faithful in a way to them.
Correct.
In the old days, men, they may have mistresses, they might have had adventures here and there, but it was impossible for them to leave their woman. While today, women are married to the state, so
yeah, exactly.
They have this illusion that they can do and live their lives the way they want. And they forget that eventually, when the state is not going to be around, who's going to protect them?
That's just it. Well, I think that's a great opening statement. I wanted to go back to part one of your book, The Century of Women. You open this chapter with a highly important line that I'm going to read. It says, "In just a few generations, we have wandered far from nature and our habits and our way of life, which had previously flowed within a rhythm set by the seasons, defined by a multitude of everyday pressing problems, and controlled by precise and strict societal norms." So can you elaborate on this a little bit?
Well, yes. If you think about, if we go very long time ago in the past, if we go back tens of thousands of years, first of all, women were never oppressed by men. Women were part of the team, which was the family. And there were different sorts of families, but depending on where you look in the world. But generally speaking, men and women were part of the same tribe.
Yeah.
And everyone was committed to make sure that the whole tribe was performing as best as they could, because it was necessity of survival, gathering or hunting enough food, gathering wood or material for fire, having a shelter in case of bad weather, and certainly in case of the winter. And this was obviously stronger in the northern climates, and this is why there are fundamental differences between people from the north, people like us in the west that have developed around Europe and the Baltic and Caucasus and even parts of Central Asia, and to some extent Asia as well. Asian people have similar patterns, and these are very different from people from the desert, or perhaps people from the tropics, from the equatorial forests or the savannah. Completely different point of view. So I'm focusing a little bit on our people on the West. And during those times, women were never considered below men. They were fully part of society, and they had a complete part to play in the survival of the tribe.
Yeah, they didn't think about egalitarianism and equality, seeing each other separate. They thought of each other as one and the same, as a team, right? Exactly.
Absolutely, as a team. And obviously, physical differences made that men would be more fit to go and hunt big animals or to fight invading tribes. And women were more fit for, of course, taking care of the children. We men cannot bear children, for sure. at least for
now, they're working on that, you know.
Yeah, exactly, and certainly that meant that there was some specialization and segregation of labor that was happening. But this was never perceived. In fact, some scholars, I'm not sure it's correct, but some scholars actually believe that in terms of calories, women were actually providing more calories to the tribe through gathering of fruits and roots and wild little animals compared to the men who would gather big animals. I'm not sure if that's correct, but certainly for sure, and no one would think of anyone as inferior or different. And that was our life for tens and tens of thousands of years. And when obviously we started to gather agriculture and herding and to be a much more sedentary, less nomadic. The religions of the Middle East, of the desert, Judaism first, but also Christianity and then Islam, started to believe that women have to be a propriety, because fundamentally, women know who are the children. The Latins used to say mater semper certa est, which means the mother knows she's the mother. She's certain about that. The man is not certain, can never be really certain. In fact, in Judaism, it's pushing to the point where only women, in theory, make the religion pass on through the blood.
Mm-hmm.
Very strange concept for religion. But certainly this is how it was perceived. And men needed to make sure that women were in the house, in the home, so that they would ensure that the children were theirs. In the past, you know, we estimate that even in tribes or that are in a very primitive way of life, there's about 20 to 30% children who are not from the father. So there is about that. So there is some sort of mixing that happens. But those approaches to make women a property suddenly spread. And indeed, we have lived from starting from the Middle East in about 2000 BC, all the way through the end of Christianity in Europe. We have lived into a real, and this, and for this I must say, the feminists are correct. There has been a time of patriarchy. Where they are not correct is that they have seen this as an oppression in all cases, in all sorts, in all places of life. And indeed, it was not the case, because when people have to work, such as in farming or in the factories later on, there had to be a partnership between the man and the woman. You could never say that the man was the master on the woman, because even if the religion was saying that, it was not the case, because life was too hard. So in fact, feminism is an invention of the bourgeois class. So the rich women, who were probably didn't have a lot to do during the day, started at the turn of the 19th century and to the beginning of the 20th century to think that it was their duty, just as they stopped slavery before. Well, it's Western women who pioneered the end of slavery. Western bourgeois women also pioneered the freedom or the fight for rights for women.
Yeah, let me read a quote to that from your book. You said that the emancipation of women gave them access to freedoms which were previously very rare and only available to a tiny elite.
Yes, and the interesting paradox is though that tiny elite actually employed at very low wages women to do all the chores, of course, taking care of the children, the house, and the cleaning. And today as well, you see a lot of bourgeois feminists who keep talking about men exploiting women, where in fact they are hiring, they have nannies,
that's true,
and maids,
yeah,
to take care of their own houses and children. So this paradox of the bourgeois class is always quite fascinating.
So then what happens, you know, modern medicine, technology, science, industrial revolution comes, and how did this collide with, you know, our centuries-old traditions and culture?
When you look at it, despite Mr. Bernays' propaganda to make sure that the suffragettes in the 1920s were on the front page of the news, the real emancipation of women starts with technology, because if men hadn't invented the washing machine, the vacuum cleaner, and so on, well, rights are all well and good. And when there's work to be done, you don't have time to think. You don't have time to fight for your rights. You just have to do it, because you cannot live in filth and with dirty children, and you need to survive. So we have to recognize that it is technology and it is modernity, which has been created by the West, once again, that has emancipated the woman. And I think in the book I show at what time women have participated into, they got universal right of vote, but also I have a chapter on when women started to participate in the war effort, first in World War I, but especially in very large numbers in World War II. And obviously after World War II, when 7 million women, for example, in the Soviet Union, fought against Germany, when millions of women worked in the factories in the United States and in England and in other countries. Well, after the war, it was very difficult to say, well, now you have to go back. It was the right time to say, well, then you can now, of course, vote, but also develop your intellectual potential, which I believe women have greatly, and of course, do what you want. Unfortunately, I think this was hijacked at some point. I think the counter-revolution in the 60s, the culture, I don't know if you call it cultural revolution in the US, but in the 60s and early 70s, this movement, which was, happening anyway, was politicized and hijacked by the usual suspects to make sure that it became a form of fight against the white Western society.
Yeah.
And we've been, because we are nice people in the West, we fell for it. And now it went too far.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up, you know, women, they first enter the workplace, think about this, in a time of war. I mean, that seems like a really bad omen. You know, they're like helping build and put together, you know, guns that are being used so that white men can kill each other. You know, so they went from this feminine realm to a masculine one practically overnight.
Yes. I take as a, you know, you probably remember in the first chapter of the book, I give the example of my grandmother, which started as a very poor factory worker. I think she started to work when she was 14, and she worked in a cookies factory in Torino, in north of Italy, and she had the entrepreneurship spirit. So to make a very long story short, she ended up after the war to own a few businesses, and despite having lost two children, she managed to have a very successful life and career, and it really showed that the times were not easy for men and women, and we should never forget that most of the people, 90% of the people in Europe and in America, they had a very difficult time, whether they were men or women. This idea that men had it good and women were oppressed is really a view from the bourgeois class. It's not the view from the proletarian or for the working people.
Thinking in terms of what you're saying, it's our ideas. One of the problems here is our ideas of human survival has drastically been changing from how our ancestors viewed it. It's become very artificial versus something really grounded in nature. So it's telling that in our modern era, you know, depression and anxiety, it's an epidemic. A lot of women are on antidepressants. So is this really the consequences of being removed from nature and self-sufficiency? I mean, because that really brings the ultimate satisfaction, right? When we're like working to provide for our families and working as a unit. What do you think?
Yes, the idea that men are not needed anymore. You know, men are very, once again, we don't know who are our children. I mean, theoretically, we don't know. Therefore, we are programmed to have as many children as we can. And this is our biological programming. Of course, civilization and care makes you go beyond that. But the idea is that you will impregnate as many women as you can, as often as you can, because we can. Whereas women is a different story. Women are limited by maybe one or two children every you know, two or three years. And therefore, they know that they will need to care for those children when they're small. And therefore, selecting the right man is very important. When the world tells them that they don't need men anymore because the state will provide, well, suddenly they don't care anymore about selecting properly. They will become more promiscuous. They will become easier to approach. And men will take advantage of that. Men will suddenly feel that, first of all, they're not needed, nor they're wanted to protect the woman in a society. And therefore, they can afford to not care or not commit anymore. And this is, by the way, something that a lot of women complain today. They say, oh, men don't commit. Well, maybe you should think about what it means to be selecting the right men, and look at how parts of our society are collapsing completely in terms of family. The first one were probably the weakest part of our societies. Look at how from the 1950s, where, for example, black Americans had the same marriage and divorce rate as white. Today, it's a complete disaster. I mean, you have the average black, I cannot call it a family, unfortunately for them.
Yeah, it's all single moms.
It's a single mom who has four children with four different men. And
I think that's common in Africa, too. This kind of commitment and being a couple is a very European thing. And
having worked in Africa, it is quite common. However, there is one advantage in Africa, is that because the state doesn't provide for anyone, the women are extremely assertive on men. So you almost have domination of women on African men in Africa, because the women, they know how the men are.
Yeah.
So they will put a lot of pressure, and it's extremely harsh. I've seen it happen. The woman will hunt them down in the evenings to know where they are, and they will drag them back home so that they don't mess around. And there is a social form of control. Whereas in the US and starting in European societies, this social control doesn't exist. And in fact, it went to the opposite way, where there is a subculture of making the criminal male to be the hero of that subculture. And those who suffer the most in reality are, of course, the children, but obviously the women who have to take care of these children on their own. And I think the real sad part is that, of course, now this breeds a high criminality, as we know, but it also spreading, this way of life, this way of culture, is spreading to other societies. It's spreading to whites, and it even starts to spread to Asians on a lesser scale. But this culture has been pushed by the media to be widespread. And so now we start to see white, let's say European women, who are suffering the same exact social problems than Afro-American or other women in society. The only ones, I must say, that are not suffering through that are the ones from the Muslim communities, which are still extremely traditional.
Now, thinking in terms of, female emancipation, wasn't it really liberation for men too, in a way? Because then they could be off the hook of being the provider and the protector, right? Kind of, you were alluding to that fact.
Yes, I think so, and I think we now understand that the results are patently disastrous, and there is a huge movement, and I can feel it in society, where both women and men are fed up of this and are moving back towards some form of traditional way of life, some form of traditional values. And this is probably the fundamental reason for some sort of Christian revival, this evangelical revival in the U.S. starting in the 80s, has probably something to do with that. And in some cases, look at, for example, someone that is a very interesting personage, a very interesting character in American political life, which is Louis Farrakhan, mm-hmm. with Nation of Islam. I mean, this guy is pushing for family, for discipline, for structure in the African-American societies. And the women are following this very much because they understand that the dangers and the risks that exist outside of the protection of a structured society provided by men are incredible. We're talking what I was discussing before, promiscuity and single woman. This is the mild problem. The big problem is rape, it's violence, it's beatings, and even killings. This is what is happening now with women on their own.
That's right. I think it's probably more dangerous for women in this current modern society that's very leftist than the old days, because of all the criminality and rampant multiculturalism, especially rapes by invaders. In the old days, the men would just hunt these guys down and go to war and take them out. But that doesn't happen anymore.
Exactly. And I've seen this. I've seen this personally in Africa during my travels. You know, if someone rapes a woman, the family of the woman will hunt the guy down and kill him. That's it. And the authorities will just turn a blind eye, saying, well, this is our customs. We don't have anything to say. Today in Europe, when a man rapes a woman, probably he gets 6 months. He probably doesn't even go to jail. And that's if he gets convicted, because probably they will find that, oh, you know, he's a poor immigrant. He didn't know. We must understand the differences of culture and things like that. It's becoming appalling. Everyone has seen these images, shocking images and news from Cologne a year ago, and from Sweden, the world rape capital after Lesotho.
Yeah.
I mean, Swedish rape in Sweden is on the levels of deep Africa. This is crazy. We cannot allow this. And women are starting to realize that they are the victims. And therefore, I mean, they're not going to rape me. I'm 6 foot tall. No one is going to rape me, believe me. But my daughters, I am scared for my good daughters. I have to teach them how to protect. They have to do self-defense. When you look at the self-defense courses across Europe, I'm sure in the US it's the same. The classes are full of women today. There is a consciousness that is starting from that, and this is survival instinct. So it's just normal.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of European women that are also quite naive because they've had it good for so long, right? They have been safe. They have been able to wear mini skirts, you know, and go out clubbing at midnight and not fear being raped. But now that's all completely changing, isn't it?
Yes, it's quite possible, and that there is some sort of natural selection at play. But you see, the problem is I'm part of my societies. I'm Swiss. I cannot say to my Swiss women citizens, look, it's going to be natural selection. You will learn the hard way. Sure, some of them might learn the hard way, but my duty as a citizen and as a fellow European is to teach them, look, and to tell them and to warn them, is to say, well, look, think about the real risks. And I have a lot of people who are, I know a lot of women who are from the left, and they start to vote extreme right. They start to vote in the right, at least, right. Or certainly, at the very least, they certainly have a consciousness catharsis, because they understand very well that being raped is not exactly pleasant, or being stoned to death by some foreign culture that is coming in our countries is not exactly pleasant. And, you know, the most stupid ones, well, they're hopeless. We see them, these social justice warriors. And, I mean, we just have to consider them insignificant, because they are insignificant. So we have to cut them out from our they're already dead. They don't That's know
right.
it yet.
That's right.
But those we can save, those that we can teach, those who have been, those who fell for the narrative of the cultural Marxism and of the left, well, we can still save them, because I think they are mature now to understand the real risk, because this is not intellectual anymore. This is really, so to speak, deep into them.
Now, another big important concept you bring up, that we can't just have endless growth and forever just expand and expect there to be no consequences. So explain how that's a bad thing, this idea of just endless growth.
This is where it links to my first book, which was about in a world of ever increasing population. Well, growth cannot continue forever. First of all, there are environmental limits, there are energy limits, and there are resources limits. And thinking that there are, you know, Africa, for example, is 1 billion people today. This is expected to double by 2050. So there's going to be 2 billion Africans in 2050. And according to the UN, if things stay unchanged, and of course, I believe this is never going to happen, because we will all collapse before, by the end of this century, Africa will be 4 billion people. So obviously, considering these are not the sharpest tool in the box as well, these guys will never be able to live in their own lands, because despite a fairly good economical growth in that continent, the growth of the people is higher, and therefore they will export more and more people who will try to go to Europe, obviously not in the US, since you are probably not going to accept anymore, which is a great thing. These people will not want to live like a farmer in Mali. These people want to live like Europeans.
Yeah, they want to live like kings.
Exactly. That means like and that means an incredible stress on the budgets, on the economy, on the local life, and so on. In fact, very interestingly, a bit unrelated to my book, but certainly, when I travel in North Africa or in the Middle East, as I travel often, I see that the Muslim countries in those areas are scared from the immigration from Africa, because they are they are swamped from these migrants. Before they can cross into Europe, they stay for months and for years in Morocco, in Tunisia, in Lebanon, in all these places. And their behavior is the same. And of course, the laws over there are much tougher.
Oh yeah, Saudi Arabia just doesn't let any of those people in.
Indeed, and nor does Israel, by the way.
No. Nope.
And by the way, they are totally correct. Yep. We must say bravo to well done, Israel, not to take people who are not from your culture.
We should be doing the same thing, of course.
Yeah, like they build walls and they say no to people who are not from their culture, and they're right to do that. So we are seeing. This is a worldwide phenomenon. This is not just limited to us. The question is, in Europe, we are weak right now, and we are not putting the laws, but also the walls and the barriers to prevent this phenomenon. But certainly, what this means is that growth will never solve this anymore. And we are stuck with not growing economies that are never going to be able to bring wealth for billions of people. And that means we will have to become tough. And we will become tough because our way of life is going to decrease unless we change our way of life to something different. And I think we have to obviously become tough. We have to learn to become tough, women included. We have to, as I explain in my books, I always push this idea of we have to become as much autonomous as possible. We have to learn to be autonomous as individuals for our survival needs, that means water, food, self-defense, culture, and so on. But also we need to learn jobs and trades that cannot depend on the global economy of the financialized, indebted world economy. We have to think of jobs that are going to exist no matter what. Plumbing, carpentry, bicycle repair, doesn't matter. There's millions of very interesting jobs.
So not interpretive dance or gender studies?
Yeah, gender studies is going to have not a bright future, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you have a great section in your book where you talk about how modern convenience has made us fragile. And this is very important. We should talk about it. But I want to just read a quote here. You said, "Have we not become as patients in a coma, hooked up to a more and more complex, fragile life support mechanism and completely dependent on it?" Let's talk about that, how we've become fragile through all this modern convenience.
Yes, well, think of where people get the food. We buy food, most of the people buy food in the supermarkets, and they buy medication from the pharmacy, from the drugstore. And they want a fuel for their car, they go to the petrol station. If they want anything that they need in their life, everything is available just in time when they need it. But this is relying on an incredibly complex machine of supply, of just-in-time supply, of incredible complexity. It's very hard for human brain to understand the complexity of this machine that Western men have created. And this machine has become fragile because it works on the basic that everything works all the time. So as soon as this system starts to have shocks, as soon as it has failures, as soon as it has different kind of problems whose cause can come from social unrest, energy disruption, lack of raw materials to manufacture the key ingredients, the spare parts, or transports that don't work for whatever reason. So the system is not going to last forever. Therefore, we have better prepare ourselves to be with the least impact if the system falls. But I would say there is a even more important reason for us to live in a different way, is that the life today in our system, as you mentioned, is not making us very happy. A lot of people are depressed. We have to take drugs. We compensate our lack of future with consumption, with sex, with whatever that is a short-term pleasure. And also I think the most sad part is we have completely lost the sense of community.
Yeah.
All of us, whether we are whites, blacks, doesn't matter. We all have lost the sense of community, and therefore we live a sad life. And this is the reason why I believe that finding a better community, learning to be self-sufficient, creating strength through those means, make us more strong and more resilient.
Yeah,
I think
the consequence of wanting constant comfort, avoiding the reality of life on this planet, we've basically outsourced our own survival, has made us weak and vulnerable and depressed because we're so out of touch with the nature, you know?
Exactly.
You were talking about also in the book, you know, that our grandparents used to stockpile, they planned for the future. Nowadays, there's no planning. It's just in time, everything. And it's that saying I always hate, live in the moment, man, you know, relax. And now I hear that millennials, they can't even cook. There was just a research study that was released and was saying that millennials go out to eat more than they spend on grocery shopping. Like they don't even know how to cook anymore.
Yes, I think that it is true to some extent. And however, because of the crisis and because of the difficulty to find jobs and therefore have enough money to eat out, a lot of young people are starting to realize that maybe the American dream has become a nightmare, and it's time to go back to self-sufficiency and ability to be more reliant on oneself. In fact, General Celente was telling me that the highest growing economic segment in the United States is farming of organic products. And more young people are leaving the big cities to go back into countryside to start organic farms.
This whole artificial system of modernity, I mean, could it even exist if it didn't rely on financing? Because in America, everyone has loans to have everything that they have.
Yes, financing and cheap energy. And both are in their death throes. So we better move ourselves very fast. And, because I deal with the problems of women in this book, there was a limit, is that I'm not one. I'm not one of them.
No,
and
you're not.
I've never been and I will never be. So clearly I couldn't say more than my opinions. So to add some credibility to my thoughts, I took this approach to have half of the book where I interviewed women on how they were actually doing it. And I found that this part of the book was fascinating in showing us that in reality, a lot of women are already doing the job, and they are doing this approach to gain back real freedom, because real freedom comes with autonomy, not from dependence of the state.
That's right.
From the state.
Now, generally, though, when it comes to planning for the future, do you think that's more of a male brain thing than a woman thing?
Well, traditionally, it was not the case. If one looks at history, one sees that women tend to be more conservative than men, and therefore more caring about the children and the future. It's only in the recent years that women have been less concerned about their family and the future. And this was the initial paradox that I started upon. I can give you some examples. During the French Revolution, 200 years ago, it was the woman who wanted to keep the king. During the Iranian Revolution in 1979, it was the woman who wanted the more traditional Islamic system rather than the more modern Shah, the kingdom. So sometimes in traditional societies, women are the guardians of tradition, where men are a little bit more entrepreneur and want to go more to the to try new things. Today is different. Women are much less traditional than it used to be.
Yeah, because you made a comment too in the book. You said feminism made women so free they forgot to think about the future.
I believe so.
I mean, we know that family units are absolutely the best. I mean, we can't survive without that. But there has been exceptions to the rule, and I often wonder with a lot of the feminists in the early days, if it wasn't a lot of women who weren't part of the status quo, like spinsters or lesbians or outcasts. What do you think about that?
Yes, or bourgeois. Once again, if you look at what you find is that the early feminists were the bourgeoisie, were the fairly wealthy, not the super wealthy, but the fairly wealthy, and it was also the if you look at technically who they were, you have a lot of Jewish intelligentsia, both with the communist on the communist part and also on the liberal part. So there, you do find this approach of trying to make other people's happiness despite them, which is a typical approach of those communities, which and always ends in disaster, by the way.
And also, I wanted to ask, do you know how the concept of a dual household income started affecting the economy negatively?
Well, yes, that, and also the divorce rate, because think of all the apartment, the construction that is needed because people don't stay together. If people stay together, you have half the fridges, half the houses, half the furniture. The economy has benefited enormously from the societal disaster that has been the sexual revolution, divorce, and all that. I'm not saying that you shouldn't be allowed to divorce or having the life you want, but de facto, when you look at it, when you analyze it, you see that while it was an economical success for a while, it has been a social and emotional disaster.
From the man's perspective, you know, what was the reason for limiting some of the rights of women? I think in many cases they were being protective, not abusive, like the movies portray, and some of it was just semantics, I think.
It was also the one has to remember that, for example, democracy in many, many countries was not for all men. It was only for men who had property. Yeah. So it's not true that men had rights and women don't. It was rich men who had rights, and poor men and women didn't have those rights. And it has never been the case that women or other men had no rights. It was just less rights. Because even slaves had rights. So one has to always look at the legal system, country by country, epoch by epoch. But certainly one has to remember that there has never been in history, even when men were more clearly there was a patriarchal society, for example, in Athens, the Athenian democracy was patriarchal. But a few hundred miles away, Sparta was not patriarchal. Sparta had queens, and the rights of women in Sparta were the same as men. They could inherit, they could own land, they could divorce, they had a lot of land. So sometimes one has to be very detailed in how one looks at that. Even, for example, if you look at war, today it's quite funny to see the armed forces full of men and transvestite and very odd people to be fighters. However, one can see that there are some incredibly strong figures of women throughout history who have had who were queens, who were fighters, who were explorers, who were scientists. But of course, this was not the norm. This was not what was common.
And some of the fighters, like Boudica, was just out of sheer necessity at the time.
As well.
Yeah.
But the norm was that women were needed by men to help them and with reciprocity to tend the fields, to tend the animals, to look after and help the children be educated. And so it has never been, the war of the sexes has never happened. The war between the genders is an invention of cultural relativism and cultural Marxism. People always saw themselves in good and bad times as a partnership. And this was, whether it was under the religion of Christianity or whatever, still the normal people were seeing each other with affection, with love, but with necessity of staying together.
Yeah, a lot of times people think of the matriarchal societies as being more pagan or goddess worshipy or something, you know, twisted in their mind. And then the patriarchal, they think of Christianity. But does society have to be either or? Can't it be something else? It should be a blend of the two, don't you think?
Yeah, and the idea of what we want in the future is something that we all need to think today. And I think that the time has now come to really reassess what women really want, what men really want. Because I believe that men are not super happy anymore, just as women are not happy anymore. Because, you know, even if promiscuity is high, in the end, so what? You have no children who look like you. You have no children who will take care of you when you're old. It's a civilizational disaster. And we cannot regress to that. So we have to think hard on how we redesign the values that build our societies. And to some extent, we can look into the past to get lessons from what worked and what didn't, but also look at perhaps new ways to look at things. But the safe bet is that as you work towards tradition, you're pretty safe.
Well, Piero, yeah. I really want to thank you, and I want to be sure that you let everyone know how they could buy your book and give us your website details.
Now, the book is published by Club Orlov. People might know Dmitry Orlov, which is quite a famous author in the U.S. He has started to publish books, so I'm quite happy to be one of the books he's publishing in the U.S. And the book can be found on Amazon, and you just type either my name, Piero San Giorgio, or a woman on the verge of societal breakdown, and it's easy to find. And people can, of course, link on my Facebook and my YouTube. I promise I will do more videos and messages in English.
Well, thank you. This is such an important topic, and I think we need to talk about this now more than ever. The relationships between European men and women especially are endangered in a lot of ways right now. So we need to work on healing that and restoring that. So thank you so much for writing this book and for your generous time today.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
More and more European women are starting to understand how liberal policies, combined with mass immigration, is a disaster that will affect their quality of life on every level. They're finding that they have to think about heavy things they didn't have to think about before. And that's why the majority of white women voted for Trump. As a reminder, this Saturday, November 19th, we will be live streaming from the NPI Alt-Right Conference in Washington, D.C. It's sure to be interesting after Trump's historic win. We have a fun 4 years ahead watching lefties cry as we push our message even harder and further in our direction. We've only just begun. This show is 100% listener supported, so if you like what we do, please consider making a donation at paypal.me/redice. Redice.tv is our website where you'll find all our public material, and redicemembers.com is our members' website for exclusive material, including our weekend live TV show, Weekend Warrior. Thanks for listening. We'll talk soon.